Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys Podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Preacher Boys Podcast. I am currently sitting on the floor in my room, if you're wondering, and leaning up against a wall, because currently we're preparing for a big move. And so everything, including my desk and my microphone setup, have been taken down and are getting ready to get shipped to our new place. And so it's starting to look pretty bare. But I wanted to sit down and record a quick intro for my friend Tia Levings. This episode's really incredible, and you'll realize that right out of the gate if you didn't already know it already from reading Tia's writings or seeing her on a little series you may have heard of called Shiny Happy People. But I was one of the privileged first guys to read A Well-Trained Wife. And this book is incredible. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. I feel so spoiled by just the plethora of incredible books that are being written, especially autobiographies that are sharing perspectives and stories that for so many years were sadly kept silent. And those of you that know Tia know she is an incredible powerhouse writer. And I mean, I feel no hesitancy to say, go grab a copy of A Well-Trained Wife right now. There's a link in the show notes of this episode where you can do just that. But this conversation with Tia was really, really special to me as someone who really appreciates her work. And I know it'll be really special to all of you who appreciate her work as well. So enjoy this conversation with Tia Levings. And be sure to drop a comment below letting Tia know that you love her, support her work, and your biggest takeaways from today's conversation. And again, be sure to grab a copy of A Well-Trained Wife wherever you grab your books. Thanks so much. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Tia, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. I've been having this on my list for so long. It's kind of amazing. It's finally here.
We're recording in February, but this is releasing in August. How do you think your summer's going so far?
Oh, it's like, it's hard to feel like August isn't tomorrow because the year's going to go so quickly. And I'm working on my second book at the same time that I'm promoting this first one, which I did not see coming and is not typical for most authors. And it just made the year, like 24 is going by in a blur. So, but I'm so stoked to be here in my book year. And, you know, I've been writing this book, working on it since 2013. So it's going to be amazing to set it down and move forward.
I'm curious to go back to really the beginning. Tell me a little bit just about like your early, like, interactions with the church in general, because I know you've been on several different branches of the church. You've experienced a lot of different shades. What's your earliest interactions that you recall within the church?
They're pretty typical. When people think about like growing up in Christian America, it was the 80s. I'm a Gen Xer, and I grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So it was a small town, and my dad's Catholic, my mom is some sort of Protestant, like it's like a all brethren kind of a thing, probably really strict and hard, but they raised my sister and I with pretty just like most Sundays we went to church, we went to Sunday school, but we were just as likely to for dad to take us out to breakfast while mom went to choir. And then, you know, we just kind of met up. I do have some early religious trauma with hell teaching and the pressure to get saved and being a very literal and visual, highly visual child, and it's very impactful, but it's a completely different flavor of Christianity than what happened when I was 10, when we moved to Florida, to the big city, which was total culture shock. And we joined a mega church. We joined the biggest church in the Southeast at the time. Our pastor was president of the Southern Baptist Convention while I was a teenager. And that church politicized at the same time that I grew up. So by the time I'm a young adult, the world has narrowed dramatically. Like it got really big because it's this big, wealthy mega church. And then it got really strict and fundamentalist, but still had that like this is what it's like to be Christian in America, mainstream fun. Like we did contemporary Christian music and we had alternative entertainment and very full social calendar because they kept us busy 6 days a week out of seven. I was at church and it was my whole world. So it's very complicated to extrapolate where it was at first, the good memories from the bad memories, because it was all my memories.
Right. Yeah. I always say that it's like, it's hard to like, just be overly happy or overly bummed out because like, right? There's so many like equal experiences where it's like, that was a lot of fun. Oh, but it was shaded with this, or now I know this about this person. It sounds like fear was a component very early on in your story. You mentioned the fear of hell. And I related very much in your book where you said you prayed the sinner's prayer after every altar call, car ride, anytime you thought you might die, which is very frequent for us fundamentalists. Yeah. But it also sounds like there was the political fears. There's fear of the opposite gender. There's fear of, you know, yourself and mm-hmm. your own body changing. Like, how frequently were you in a state of fear throughout your early childhood and teenage years?
That is such a good question. And it's something that I think I come to more awareness as I work through recovery, because just when I think I've like identified all the scary monsters, there's another layer of another lurk. I think it's fair to say I lived every day in fear one way or the other. Because there's tangential things in my story, like sexual violation or culture shock from moving from such a dramatic place, bullies, hell always, rapture fears always, fear of the making a mistake, you know, perfectionism, and that we would go the wrong way was a very big deal in my high school years. I think I was always afraid. I was very afraid of stepping outside the line and not belonging, not being loved, but also really bad things happening, like getting decapitated or getting left behind in the decapitated because of the rapture, because of the tribulation movies, to give that some context, but also, you know, just being left behind and unwanted. I think every day.
I mentioned fear because that's such a weapon within the church. And I say the church, the evangelical machine at large, right. You know, it whether Southern Baptist, whether in the Pentecostal world or whether the Independent Baptist or IBLP kind of world, fear is how they pack the pews and keep people in the pews. Okay. And your first experience with a guy, for me, reading that story, it's tragic because it's a horrific assault that you describe in the book, but also it's a confirmation at that time that everything the church had been teaching you about everything was true. And it seems like, at least reading the book, it seems like that kind of set you or increased your speed in a direction that you were already being pushed toward in terms of loyalty to the church and not wavering from the Christian path.
It very much did. And it's just so interesting to me that that was as powerful as it was, because I didn't put my finger on that until I wrote the book. Hmm. I had to, the way the writing of the book came about was that I was in therapy and my therapist suggested I start writing some of my experiences down so that I could objectify them a little bit and get them out of my body and onto the page. And we were dealing at the time with like the sexual assault in my marriage and the fact that I'd had this escape and like the more visceral things at the end of my story. And then we were tracing them back, like through that process, we were going, like, what led you to that? And then we'd have to go back and back and back. And that's how I discovered what religious trauma was. Like, it was kind of running parallel to that phraseology hitting on social media. And so my discovery was kind of tracking with that. Mm. But that particular scene I included as I was doing the reverse, what happened beforehand, what happened before that. And I wasn't something I counted as a big trauma. I was so dissociated from it. I didn't understand the weight of that experience until other readers started reading my book and they would bring that one up. And it started first with my coach. And she's like, this is the scene that really got me, because I realized it locked you down. And that's the first time I heard that. That was the first time I had seen that. And so it's one of the reasons why I recommend writing so much to survivors, because you will see your story from an entirely different angle and be able to see it from a more a high level objective view and trace the sources of what happened to you, which I think language, putting language to our experiences is probably the key thing that helps us move on from them and put them into context in our lives. So yeah, it's interesting to me that you brought that up. And yes, it did all of those things. It confirmed absolutely that what the church was saying was true. Left to my own devices, I would go wrong. The world was a scary place. It was an experience outside of their control, but it was absolutely groomed and used for me to interpret it the way that it was, and for me to interpret it as my own mistake and not as an assault. Yeah. I didn't even tell anybody. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell anybody.
Whether writing or whether talking about your story in a podcast format or being interviewed in a series, you know, like when you start talking to somebody who is outside that bubble and you watch their reaction to your story,
right,
that's when you start going, oh, like this was messed up, you know? And it's a very, I think, comforting thing, because it makes you realize like, okay, I'm not crazy. This is something really bad. But also it can be a roller coaster of uncovering these new traumas and these new things that maybe you thought you were fine, or my parents weren't that way, or this guy wasn't this way. For you, how do you keep that kind of, I mean, how do you maintain mental health while constantly unpacking years of baggage and things and realizing like, oh, this was way worse than I thought in many of these cases?
That is also such a great question. I am dogged about my mental health recovery because I refuse to give any more ground to high control religion. So it has made me very fierce about protecting myself and doing the work, whatever work I have to do to overcome something. It is not acceptable for me to stay in a victim place or to be debilitated by my past. It already got my past. I already will never get those years back. So how I maintain that is by being very intentional with what I'm here for. Like, I'm here in therapy. So it can be very, very specific. I'm in therapy to deal with this memory. And here are the supports that I will have around me while I work through it. So that includes making sure that people around me know that I'm working through something hard, setting good boundaries, which I had to learn how to do. I didn't know how to do that. Creature care and self-care comforts, like just the animal of your body and what it needs in order to do heavy psychological lifting. All of that has been learned over the years, and all of it is in place because this work is hard and this work is life. Like, there's not an end to recovery. I don't believe there is, because so far I'm in 17 years of it, and I'm still discovering things that, oh, there's another layer. So I have to deal with that. So
it's, yeah, there's no certificate of completion. Like, correct. You did it.
It's a death certificate.
Yeah. I'm curious. This is a question that's come up. Someone asked me this. I think it was Nippy on A Little Bit Guilty asked this question, and it's like stuck in my brain ever since. And he basically asked, when you grow up in a culture where all of this stuff is normalized, how do you even see red flags? You know, and Tiffany Bloom said something similar, like you can't see red flags through rose-colored glasses. Like, it's a really interesting thing because you are growing up in a bubble. You don't have outside perspective. Like, how do you even begin recognizing that something is wrong? And, you know, so much of your book hits on those things you just talked about, which is, I thought I was the one that was a problem. Oh, I shouldn't have made so-and-so mad. I shouldn't have left the safety of the church. I shouldn't have told my parents I'm going here and not here. Like, all of the teaching, both explicitly and the implicit teaching that we take in just by watching people, affects how we view the world. Like, how did you go from just going, this is me, this is normal, to here I'm seeing cracks within this system?
That is so good. I especially love the point with the rose-colored glasses and not being able to see the red flags.
Yeah.
My self-perception was completely skewed, and I had no perception of what was normal. What happened to me was I stayed in danger for too long. I can see that in hindsight. And I had to get to a place where I didn't know if it was any different out there. I just knew I couldn't handle it in here anymore. I almost died. Like, I came as close to death as I can get. And it shouldn't have gotten that far. But I didn't leave thinking I was going towards normal. I thought I was leaving just for relief. I just couldn't handle that pain anymore. So it took recovery for me to discover where the red flags were, what I had missed, what was life out here really like, because I'd been lied to about what life was like out here over and over again. And so I just had no frame of reference. It was pure survival move to leave that night. And I had no idea what I was leaving into. Could have been worse, but I doubted that.
Yeah. It's like, how could it be worse than this?
Yeah. Right.
The red flags is interesting too, because I used to always ask, what's the first red flag you noticed? And then it's like, well, this is not helpful practical information, because you probably blew past 30 red flags at least before you started noticing. Looking back at the culture that you said on one podcast really groomed you to be prey for predators, and this happened in many different forms, eventually with your own husband, which is a terrifying thing. What are some of the first red flags within the system that you wish you would have recognized? If you could go back to young Tia and say, hey, wake up, look at this. This is not normal. With what I know now, don't go down this path. What red flag do you wish you would have seen?
There are so many. There are so many. Where I'm drumming right now, and it's right along this red flag progression, is that the ability to see red flags comes from the ability to think critically. And people can think critically when they have got a healthy sense of self. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my therapy at the moment is going towards child development, like reparenting myself in child development. Because if you are protecting a child's autonomy and allowing them to develop the way they're supposed to, around 6-7 years old, they should be able to say, hey, someone hurt me. Hey, this doesn't feel good. Hey, I'm scared. I couldn't say any of those things at that age. So I'd already been, there had already been red flags, and the people caring for me should have caught them, but didn't, you know. And some of that's the 80s, because I come from a feral generation, but you know, like, I'm not trying to assign blame. I'm trying to see where the markers were. Certainly by the time I was going through my rebellious phase, which I now know was grief as a prepubescent child, and I was in this mega church and things were not, they were not okay. I wish I could have said, Mom, my youth pastor just taught me what a golden shower and an orgy are. I want like that. Please don't send me back to camp. I wish I could have said stuff like that. I couldn't. I didn't know that it was wrong because it was coming from my pastor, you know? So I didn't, but I wish I could go back and say, like, cover her ears. Like, I learned so many things at church that were R-rated while they were telling me not to go to block.
Yeah.
You know, like, I wish I could go back and just protect her a little bit. Innocence was robbed at church far and away more than outside of church. And that's one of the great ironies that I really try to make a point of in my work today. You're more likely to be interfered with, molested, violated by somebody you know. And if you're always at church, that's going to be your church. Also, churches do a really shitty job of accountability when abuse, you know, comes to light. And all of those years, abuse was coming to light. There would be gossipy scandals at the church. And then that's how we ended up in the Independent Baptist Church, was through one of those gossipy scandals. And it should have generated an entirely different conversation. And it didn't. We just continued in this funnel, this ever narrowing funnel.
Yeah, that is definitely a great way to describe your path, is this narrowing funnel. And it's you really start the book in a way where I'm reading it going, I can't imagine listening to this type of music growing up Independent Baptist, you know? I can't imagine going to the hip church in this area and all that kind of stuff. And then it starts feeling more and more familiar as you work through the book into, okay, well, she just started a little higher in the funnel and is working into the things that are familiar. I'm curious because, you know, you mentioned before we hit record, the Independent Baptist side gets glossed over within your story. Obviously, Gothard is very much a bridge between a lot of these worlds, the SBC, the IFB. He's influenced both. Talk to me a little bit about the Independent Baptist chapter for you. Let's get the exclusive on the IFB experience.
I know I never get to talk about this part because it gets glossed over, but
if not this podcast, which one?
Yeah. Right? Exactly. I think I was kind of saving it for this actually, but, no, it's like, it truly was a bridge. So I learned about Gothard and the IBLP when I was at that mega church, but I was already married and in super, high control marriage and mm-hmm. and church at that point. Like, it was, life was delicate, life was eggshells, and it was, and it was painful. And I was pregnant early, really quickly, and I needed to keep my baby sleeping at night, which is, this is the story of how I reached out to my mentors. And shortly after, I mean, about a year of that mentorship, there was a scandal after, I think, two or three scandals in the big church that made this little church within a church, was what had happened. Bill Gothard's evangelizing method is to send people who've gone to conferences back into their churches to recruit within churches. And so what would happen is you'd have like an independent minded, fundamentalist minded church within this bigger church. And they thought they were doing okay, you know, letting somebody else pay the bills, just giving your tithe, you know, but it didn't stay okay because the pastors at this big church didn't much like that there was this faction, you know, forming in their congregation. And I suppose a case is to be made that they were trying to shepherd the wider mainstream and not allow this super strict sect to develop. But it also was a power play between the men.
Yeah,
exactly. So
many things can be true, but it also is this thing that's always funny to me about the corporate nature of the modern church, mm-hmm. where it has to be very businessy by nature of the fact that they have a mortgage and they have all of these things. And so not only do you need to know the gospel, you need to know our brand of it, and please purchase our brand of it to keep our lights on. It mm-hmm. just feels very non-religious and very like competing brand approach to religion. Yeah.
And our pastors, we had two, they were more of the Billy Graham style of evangelizing. Mm-hmm. Model, unless the Bill Gothard, and we had 11 city blocks of power, you know, like they take over downtown Jacksonville. And so they're not going to share power with these patriarchal men who think that they're outside of the law here. And so the whole group just picked up and moved into this, they kind of cannibalized this other church that was pastored by a man who is the rejected, heir apparent to one of the co-pastors of this big church. So he left there with a big chip on his shoulder, and he was all too happy to take this fundy group under his wing. Here's our building. And we did, we took over. There was a tiny congregation of blue-haired elderly that had been trying to hold on to their little Baptist church. And we just eradicated them with our quiverful families. Like, I don't know, like 150 people came, and it was really only 10 families.
I was going to say, yeah, well, outbirth them for sure. Yeah, it's wild. I this is total aside. Did you see the TikTok that was posted recently where it's like this, I mean, there's a whole brand of that too, of the stay at home mom movement, but mm-hmm. it's a video basically of this woman who's pregnant in the kitchen making food, and she's saying the way that we're going to beat them is by having more children. It's like very explicit, like here's
the
game plan.
They are very explicit.
And yeah, I was just like, wow, they're saying the quiet part really out loud in public.
And they have every Sunday. This is the part that confounds me. People mm-hmm. act like this is a surprise. And I'm like baffled. Why?
It's certainly not within the church, no. But it certainly is to the public outside the church. Because the message to the outside is, come to the church, come as you are, do that. And then it's like that moving goalpost once you're inside to go this.
Yeah. Here's our open secret. We, you know, don't let you use birth control because we need population dominance.
Yeah, exactly. Who were some of the biggest influences within the independent church that you were in? I know you mentioned like blanket training and things started coming into play very quickly. The more you moved away from kind of the more mega church model. So I have to imagine, you know, the Train Up a Child, you know, kind of books and things were big. What were some of the other big influences that really affected your perspective and I mean, even more so your husband's perspective?
Yeah, it was really during our independent years where he narrowed the most. It was a definite pivot into more fundamentalist extremism than I think we would have encountered had we gone, like, say, from the Baptist church to the PCA Pres church, if we'd skipped the IFB step. Instead, we were like in this pressure cooker. So it was Michael and Debbie Pearl, Doug Phillips and Vision Forum, which was prettier, but that was kind of on our way out even. Because there's this like little ugly basement IFB thing that happens in that time. I don't know if you put your finger on it, but it's like everybody's making these flyers in their basement and the materials are ugly and small and there's no big money for big publishing, you know? There were sermon tapes, AM radio, pastors. I don't remember their names. Like it just seemed like the more obscure, the more sacred it would seem. So then there's deep attraction for the alternative.
Your ex-husband, reading his story, he's such an archetype of so many people that I know. Mm-hmm. Like, and you see, and I saw, as far as the belief side of things, I saw myself do the similar path where it was like, okay, I'm leaving this. Now I'm in the John MacArthur world. Then I'm in the Apologia world. Then I'm in the Mark Driscoll world. And like, you're just, you're trying to like, at the R.C. Sproul, like when you mentioned getting the table talk stuffed in the mailbox, like trying to figure out where you're at. And I think there's people that, like for myself, I think there was earnestly, like I'm trying to figure out what the heck do I believe? Because everything keeps revealing itself to be wrong and I'm on to the next. But then I see other guys go through that journey and it just seems like they're enjoying the obscurity. Like you said, like the people that are very unknown, the books that sell 20 copies and they have one of them. Mm-hmm. What do you think the draw is of leaving the power and the massive mega church world filled with resources to these obscure, seemingly less financially beneficial, less power beneficial within like the community? Like, what's the draw to obscurity?
I think actually it mirrors how they feel inside. I think that they feel obscure, so they find validation in an obscure small resource. They feel outside of society, so something else that's outside of society feels like the answer. His psychology was taking such a hit in those years. I mean, he was trying so hard. And everything that was healthy was shamed. So the more closed he became, the more afraid he became, paranoid, the more a paranoid type resource would appeal to him because it validated what he was feeling inside. And I think to my lane, my swim lane at home, that was an extent true too. It felt like, okay, we're not supposed to be in the world, but not of it. So this is going to be weird stuff. This is, we're supposed to be different than the world. And the more different it could be, the more idealized and healthy it seemed. You know, like I had a lot of country simplicity, homesteading idealization in my background, as simple as Little House on the Prairie and, you know, English literature and things like that. And so it felt very aligned to make lifestyle choices that like voluntary poverty, voluntary simplicity. I remember this book. This is a really random memory that's coming up. There was a writer named John Knox, but he wasn't the John Knox. He was just like
another guy named John Knox.
Yes.
His sales are just people confused on which person they're buying the book from. Yeah.
That's the exact conversation I had with the guy who gave it to us. And I was like, oh, John Knox. I'm like, okay. Like put him into context in English history. And he's like, no, not that one. This guy's like in Lakeland, Florida or something. And this is his book.
That's funny.
And then we would spend our time reading that, you know, and espousing strange views.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Every single day, I'm dealing with extremely heavy topics like the ones I talk about on this show. And as much as I love hearing from others, it can be easy to neglect my own mental health. And that's why I'm so thankful for BetterHelp. You guys know I don't talk about products that I don't personally use myself. And to be honest, I was really skeptical stepping into BetterHelp for the very first time. I had never really done any formal therapy, and the idea of doing video therapy seemed really intimidating and scary, and I questioned whether it would actually be helpful. Well, now I'm almost a month into BetterHelp, and I have had such an amazing experience. Picking an incredible therapist that's understood and really fit my needs and my schedule has been an absolute game changer for me. And so I'm a really big fan of BetterHelp. And if you're thinking about starting therapy, it's a great place to give a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your ever-changing schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I actually switched therapists after my very first appointment, and the second person that I used became someone who I absolutely loved, and I can't imagine a better therapist for what I need. So never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/preacherboys to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/preacherboys. All right, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, you're so groomed to, I mean, just the verse, you know, you're peculiar people. And I remember we'd hear that all the time in terms of dress. Like, yeah, you're wearing a suit in Southern California in 80 degree weather. Like, you're peculiar people. Yes, you're wearing that weird skirt. Or yes, you're wearing culottes, but you're a peculiar people. Like, it was kind of the catch-all for every weird thing, you know? And it really is a thought terminating thing. It's like, man, I feel very, very weird right now. I'm on the right path. Do you think, and I this last question I'll ask where you try to determine what was going on inside his head, but do you think that your ex-husband was a true believer in terms of, did he truly believe the things, or did he see them as a tool to accumulate power within the home?
Oh, both are true.
Okay.
Yeah, both are true. I think he's a very ardent, intelligent person, very sick psychology, without any help. And he really did believe, like, I think upon pain of torture, he would have answered this way. So I do think he did believe, but it was also the power that made him feel more secure. So
yeah,
it was definitely means to an end.
Many things are true.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to you, I know that you describe through all of these churches, I mean, and again, even with outside the bubble of the church, like various moments of severe abuse, physical abuse and sexual abuse. But you talked about on a podcast I was listening to recently that gets talked about a lot. And I know you probably sit on podcasts like this and they dig through all of those things. But one of the things you mentioned that gets left out of the conversation is the topic of neglect. And I thought that was a really potent thing to hear. And I think it's a good reframe for someone doing a show like mine, where, you know, I either have people saying, oh, you dive too deep into these topics, or, you know, why are you spending all the time talking on this? Like, it's hard to know where to navigate these conversations sometimes in a way that's respectful, but also actually share some information of what happened so people know.
Mm-hmm.
But neglect is something that I think should be talked about, especially within the terms of marriages within these kind of fundamentalist groups. A lot of people would probably relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think neglect is really another form of abuse that can be just as horrific as the immediate physical or like the easily identifiable abuse that we usually talk about?
Yeah, neglect is really like a petri dish where bacteria can thrive. You have to create an environment. If you just plop overt violence into a healthy environment, the health will overtake it. Like, somebody will get reported, the police will get called, you know, things will happen. You first need a very parched, lonely, malleable environment in to drop that into. And there's like an ecosystem at that point, right? You know, like, it's not somebody coming in and just out of the blue abusing somebody. And I understand why these like violent plot points are, they're sensational. You know, there's something to talk about that happened. And it really is important to look at, like, well, the 50 steps that came before it that allowed that to fly. A neglected person we are built for connection as human beings. So a neglected child, a neglected wife is going to be much more cooperative to anything that is extreme or alternative. And again, these family systems do not exist just to be high control family systems. These are points on the pyramid towards, you know, dominionism. So what's happening in your family is a model of what is going to happen on a wider scale. And so you have to have very compliant people, you know, in order to do that. And neglect is how it's achieved. I think neglect is one of the most important things we talk about, because you just won't get that compliance any other way.
It's almost like within these patriarchal, you know, dominion focused groups, people don't exist, just bodies.
That's right. Know?
And it seems like the amount of, especially for groups that talk about people being made in the image of God, the lack of respect for people's humanity is so gross within these stories. And you see that in everything from the way that women are treated and objectified, because they're objectified immensely within this culture. You see this with the children who, you know, you've mentioned in many places are replaceable and interchangeable. Like they're just other kids to help with the other kids.
Right.
You know, I mean, how do you go about claiming your personhood when you've lived as just a body for so long? Like, how do you go about identifying in the healing process going, okay, now, I mean, for you, when you left, you had three kids when you first thought about leaving. You had five at the time you.
I've had five total, and I had four when I left.
You had four when you left. Mm-hmm. Like, you're going, who am I as a mom? Who am I as a person, as an individual? Like, there's so many things to unpack there. Like, how do you go about pursuing that individuality when you were just a body, a cog in the system for so mm-hmm. long?
Yeah, this is what my second book is about, actually. I had no sense of self, and I had to rebuild one from the ground up. And I should have developed this at 4 and 5 years old. Like, this is something that we should all have developed in early childhood, and we didn't because they systemically shut it down. And it makes us prey. Someone with a healthy sense of self does not become prey. They assert themselves against the pressure. So my driving force when I came out was to not be prey ever again. I had some false starts. I definitely made some mistakes. And it was part of my discovery process of, I've got to heal myself, or I'm going to just fall back right into what I did before, what I had before. And then all of this escape and pain will really essentially have been for nothing. Mm. So, I mean, it really looks like, it looks like being a little kid again. I mean, I had to rebuild my ego, my psyche, my preferences. I had to kind of do a tandem therapy where I'm dealing with the harm and the fallout and the damage of trauma, but I'm also like rebuilding at the same time. And it's, I use the word reclaiming a lot because I'm reclaiming something that always should have been mine, which is me.
Yeah.
I should have always been mine. And it's kind of a parallel journey. Like, I don't, when I get pushback too, like people are saying, you know, like, why are you always talking about this? Or why can't you move on? And what I most want to convey to them is there's no moving on until you've metabolized what's happened to you and you replace it with something healthier. Like, both have to be true. You have to take care of the trauma and the wounds, but if you don't regrow new muscles, you know, new body, you won't really heal. You will never be whole again. And I find that unacceptable. Mm-hmm. I deserve to be whole. So they fucked it up. I'm going to fix it.
Yeah. Absolutely. You're allowed to do whatever you want. Go ahead. Okay. It's funny because I always, now I'm going to ruin the illusion, but I'm a proponent of cussing, and I cuss frequently outside the show, but I've always been like, careful, because I don't want to alienate unnecessarily, you know, people that want to listen to the show who would be turned off. But I've always allowed guests, because the last thing I'm going to do is be like, you're going to share your story for the first time. Let me censor you and how to do that. Right. But it is funny because, like, I always am aware of it when I meet someone in person and then it comes out and I'm like, if they know me from the show, this is like very weird. I wanted to ask, as far as, I have two questions, but I'll ask this one first. As a parent who had kids in fundamentalism, mm-hmm. I know that there has to be a feeling of guilt that sits there, at least in the initial process of leaving fundamentalism, where it's like, oh, I dragged them into that mess too. Mm-hmm. And I know that from talking to many people who've expressed that. And I know that already as a parent myself, there's already things where I go, ah, shoot, I messed up that thing. Mm-hmm. I can never get back their 3-year-old self and redo that. And then that's when there's other layers to that, it probably makes that feeling a lot more immense. Like, how do you go about forgiving yourself for being in a system like that with mm-hmm. kids? And how do you go about having conversations moving forward with your kids to help them, yes, deal with what has happened, but also inform them like, hey, this is where we were and where our trajectory could have been. Like, here's how to stay far away from that path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is great. It's a lot. Like, it's all of the things. And I think this is where being able to hold
parenting me, as a whole, right? is a lot. Yeah.
It's a lot.
And then this religious trauma.
Oh God. I think this doing the work to be able to hold mutual truths at one time is going to be a huge asset, especially in this area, because I wake up with guilt of complicity almost every day. And I have to go through this process of remembering that high control religion has one goal, and that is to groom the next generation of perpetuators. And sometimes they groom perpetrators, and they have a way of making you be somebody that you're not or you never wanted to be. I was a very good mother to my young children, and we had these high control religious influences. They were disciplined too much, too hard. There was indoctrination that happened. Ultimately, I don't feel bad for taking them out of it, save their lives. and I did so at an age, they were 10 to 2 when we left, that I was able to completely change the way they were raised in older childhood, which was really important, I think, because I've always had a very transparent openness with them that they can always come to me and talk to me about something that they suffered, and I will hear it without defensiveness. My door is always open, and as many times as they want to hear that I'm sorry for something, I will say it. Now, my kids are really understanding. We've had great conversations. That's not like they're asking me for apologies every day, but they are young adults that are daily grappling with their own childhood, and that is the truth. And so there will be new things that come up and new angers. They've had a lot of loss in their years. And they had a mom who was recovering from trauma the same time that I was raising them. So there's fallout that wouldn't have existed if I hadn't have been in a traumatized state. And that's probably what makes me most angry. Not so much the years when they were young children and I was full-time there for them. I really miss the years that I was dissociated or on the verge of nervous breakdown multiple times, really dealing with a lot of trauma activation, how hard it is to adequately mother when you're in hiding. I was on the road with them for years, you know? So there's a lot of just loss to grieve, just to accept it and to grieve it and to talk about why I was there and why this happened and to show up better today. So, life is still ongoing. I'm still their mom. And we have a whole new relationship as adults that, I'm learning as I go because I didn't know. But I will never protect an ideology over them. And so they can always hear me say that. They are more important to me than the ideology. And they were then too, which is why I left it. But, obviously in the young years, and they lost their father through this process, so this is complex.
And it's sad that saying I would choose my kids over any ideology is a radical thing to say. Mm-hmm. But for many, even listening to this episode, there's probably still some that would say, is that true of the system I'm in right now? Is that true of the, maybe it's a less fundamentalist church that I'm in? Is there an ideology that would push you to choose between your kids and the church? And that's the scariest thing that's come. I mean, I don't know if it's the scariest. There's been a million scary things that I've realized doing this show. But one of the scariest things to me is when I started covering abuse stories, I used to go, these people don't get it, but what if it happened to one of their kids? What if it happened to their sister? What if it happened to their brother? What if it happened to their mom or their dad? And then the scary thing is when you see stories where it does happen to someone they know, and they still choose the church. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where to categorize that. Like, I don't know where to put that in how I view them as a person or how I view, because even when I was bought in, like once I realized like how bad something was, the decision to leave was clear.
Yeah.
And I can't understand, like once it happens to someone, that's not enough to drive you out. Like, oh, you're deep in this and I don't know how you're going to get out.
I hold that too, because I have origin family that's still very like they're MAGA people. They're still very evangelical. And at the same time, they love me and want to support me, but they don't understand me. And I just don't see where it's confusing.
Well, I want to ask you one more question. Then I have a complete rabbit trail question that I want to ask you, but I think it'll be interesting. This question really is to the writing side. You mentioned a little bit ago, there's people who say, get over it, or like, why are you still writing about this? Like, believe it or not, I get those same questions doing this, you know, I'm sure you can imagine. And I do think there are people, you know, that should be writing their story privately for right now.
Yes.
And aren't ready to share publicly. There's people who I've actively encouraged, like, hey, don't do a podcast yet. Like, work on healing privately first. And not everyone needs to be public. Like, there's all kinds of layers to that. However, I do think it's interesting that people want you to stay silent about your own life and your own life story. Mm-hmm. So I guess I want to meet somewhere in the intersection of when do you know you're in a place where you can, or I should say where it would be beneficial for you to share your story in a public setting? And then how do you go about doing it in a way that's not actively re-traumatizing you and taking you back to an unhealthy state of mind versus, like, you know, the normal advice is just bury that in a box somewhere and never address it, which isn't healthy either. So what's the kind of, like, in the Venn diagram of, like, healthy, unhealthy, like, where in the middle is it a good spot to be sharing your story and putting that expression?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I agree. There are people who share prematurely. They invite the public into what should be a private process. And that is re-traumatizing. I think there's a term called titration. I think it's really important here, where you add a little in at a time and you adapt to it and you see how it goes. And then you add it a little back the other way and you try it. And so when I started my book, it started as a journal with my therapist and it stayed there for a couple years, you know, and I was actively working on my trauma therapy at this time. And then I tried it as a novel, because she's like, you have a story here. So, but I was too personal to me. I was having symptoms, you know, from it. So I tried it as a novel and then I was able to just go back and forth. Like, I think it's very important that you not exploit yourself and become your own abuser. And there's this, something we carry. And when we come out of high control religion is we're used to being consumed and we're used to being martyrs for the cause. And sometimes we will do that to ourselves because we're convinced that what we have to offer is going to save someone else. That is not a motivation to share your most intimate secrets.
Right.
For me, when I started sharing and I knew it was okay, I was 10 years into therapy. Josh Duggar's trial hit the news. I realized what happened to me in private had wider contextual relevance, and I had something to say. And I was at that point able to say it without hurting myself. I'd already done so much work for it. And so then it poured out of me. It poured out of me in a way that replenished me to share it. I felt relevant to, like, what I was saying was relevant. And so I wasn't drained from it. I was actually charged, which is really important when you start this work. It's draining. It's hard, you know, this is hard work. So if you can get energy from helping someone and seeing an applicability, then you're not just sending your story out into the universe to be consumed. I think we're getting a little saturated with trauma porn and, you know, stories that just exploit what happened. There's a really good memoir book called The Situation and the Story. And it helps, like, little tiny book, just a little craft book, but it helps you see that what happened to you is not the story. It's what you took from that you interpreted and what meaning you used it for. That's the story that builds the connections that helps tell a cohesive story that's compelling. So my book is very compelling. People read it very quickly and they find relevance in it very quickly. That's different than me just listing, guess what happened next? And guess what happened next? And this is in our government, and it's just random and popping everywhere. And you can't, there's nothing tying it together in a good way.
Yeah. I viewed the podcast when I first started it was very much a, I did it very wrong, like in terms of personally. I think I did a lot more things right in terms of the public facing podcast, but in terms of like personally pacing myself, no, not good, you know? And, but now, yeah, you learn. And I feel like now, and it seems like what you're describing with the writing, to me, it's like almost because it's such a hyper-focused thing, it has become a thing where I can talk about religious trauma in the context of the podcast and then have my life. And I feel like before I was just bleeding everywhere all the time. And it allowed me to kind of do focused surgery on specific topics, talk with people like yourself who get it. And then also after this call, I can go on a walk and check my mail and go about doing my stuff in my business. And like, I can have a life in addition to it, instead of that constant buzzing hum in the background of just trauma, 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 trauma all the time. And I think that's a really healthy place to be. I said I had one rabbit trail question, but you asked something, you kind of hinted at something, and I want to just pull on the thread. And if I don't get to my rabbit trail question, oh well. You mentioned there's some people who have the martyr complex in the advocacy space. This is something I've been having a lot of private conversations about. It seems to me the same way that people move from the megachurch world to down the funnel into these obscure kind of spots because they want more power. I've seen a lot of people that pivot from extreme fundamentalism into extreme advocacy with very little time.
Yeah.
And I see them as kind of just rabid fundamentalists in the advocacy world. And I feel like they're doing it for power. I recently told somebody there's a certain name, and I said they really come off to me as like the kind of frat boy feminist, where like they're saying the right words to get laid, you know, like that seems like the vibe.
Yeah.
Or they want the platform, they want the book deal. I see a lot of pastors doing this pivot. Do you notice that trend as well? What do we do about it?
You can smell it. You can smell really, it. When you see their content, you're like, oh, there's a grift.
It's the guys that share like the memes from the Barbie movie because they know it'll get the attention, but it's like there's no time to the thoughts. Yeah.
Right. And there's an entitlement. They are used to being the loudest voice in the room. And so they're just going to change rooms. I don't have any tolerance for it at all. I say that because it's reckless. I spend my time talking about anti-fundamentalism because it's not just religious fundamentalism that we encounter. And when people don't actually deconstruct the attitudes that got them into high control religion, they just bring that with them into the recovery space. And we have seen this in the recovery space. We've seen celebrities come and go. We've seen scandals. We've seen ego trips. You know, they trip all over themselves. We've seen aesthetics rule, like, and pull aside, and this trend almost take place for what is a deeply spiritual and personal journey. And we toss around the word trauma like it's a buzzword, but that is massive pain. That is the kind of stuff that ends lives. Like, it's not something to toss around carelessly and put into your, you know, 30-day workshop and put with a glossy photography, you know, at a big national park or whatever it is. You know, you can't gloss that and shine the turd. It's the same turd. Like, it's just not okay. So when I see it, I back away. My nervous system activates really quickly. I think we could have predators on our hands and scandals, and I don't want that.
Well, we just saw that. I mean, there was just a therapist that was literally doing that kind of stuff, you know? And it's like, it's just something that's crazy. And it's funny because, not funny, haha, like none of this is, but it's interesting to me. I was just at a retreat with like several people like that all work in different spaces in the advocacy world and have really cool credentials and experiences and things. And it was just interesting as we started having the kind of private conversations, and you'd mention a name and everybody would go, yeah, they just gave me a bad vibe. I don't know what it is, but we all know, like, we can all see, like, there's that thing that just is so off. And it's something I've been wanting to talk about more and more, but I also know it's like dealing with fundamentalism again, because people are kind of that default fundamentalist mindset. You start kicking that hornet's nest and, you know, the hornets start buzzing. So
well, you can tell someone's done their work.
Yeah.
And you can tell when there's a humility to their work and a genuine calm that doesn't to exploit either themselves or others.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it takes time. And also I think we're wise to be wary. And if we're not being wary, then we haven't learned our lesson. We're probably going to get another one.
Right. Yeah. That's the other important piece of it too, is like your gut feeling is important, and I think trust it. But I also think you don't know them either. So like it's time on both sides. Like there's a reason, like there's people I really don't care for in the advocacy space, but I don't have anything to base that on other than my gut feeling. So I'm not going to go blast them on Facebook and be like, I just think they're doing it for the wrong reasons, you know, but also there's people that I really like who I waited a long time. Like I've watched your stuff for a minute before ever connecting, you know, and it's I've read a lot from you, and I mean quite a bit now, you know? And so it's good to get to really not just trust the first impression, but build that over time. I'm going to ask you this. If we're going to keep it short, it'll be okay. But I just want to know, because this is something I dig at all the time. I know there's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there. There's a lot of people out there who, you know, they send me stuff about like, oh, the Masons run all these churches and all this weird stuff. But I am curious, really, truly. I know the belief system about we want dominion over the country, over the world. We're going to be fruitful and multiply. So we have our Christian soldiers, our armies, our quiver full of arrows to launch at the establishment, like all this sorts of stuff. What do you think the end goal of that is? I know it's power within the individual dynamics. Why do you think there's such a desire for the nationalist kind of point of view and the large scale version? Because I go back and forth all the time to, do they truly believe they're bringing in the kingdom of God? Or is that just the easiest way to paint the desire for power? Like I always wrestle with true believer or not when I'm dealing with looking at so many of these stories, like the Duggar family or the, you know, whatever you want, the Bill Gothards of the world. Do you think the goal in mind is just purely as much power for me and my own camp as possible? Or do you think that there's true believers at the top pulling the strings?
Oh, that's such a good question.
Such an easy one with 2 minutes left. Here, let's talk about this.
I think that they are interested in the power for their temporal selves, but I don't think they're used to being honest with themselves. So they may really believe that they believe, but it's only because they're not psychologically healthy enough to admit that they just want a jet. They just want the biggest, you know, ministry. They want the tithe dollars. They want to be in charge of the country because they're too insecure to live in a world where they're not in control of everything.
That's a great, succinct, beautiful answer to that. And I want to add to that too, because I know the instant thing, I always play devil's advocate in my mind. Yes. I know people are going to go, well, my pastor's been pastoring the same little church for forever. He doesn't care about a jet. He doesn't care about this. Mm-hmm. Power looks different in different ways. And I just had Nadine Macaluso on, and she talked about like most people are driven by power, money, or sex. Mm-hmm. And if you look at most of these, like there's large pastors, people say, oh, he didn't have a ton of money to his name. Well, did he have a congregation of 80 people that were willing to do anything at the drop of a hat? Yes. Like we have to start asking more deep questions than is everybody Kenneth Copeland, you know, like
right, exactly.
I think it gets lost there, but look, I could talk to you for hours. I'm sure I'll have you back on maybe to talk about this next book. For people who are listening right now, your book is out right now. I want to go pick up a copy of a totally different book. I forgot I read the PDF. You've got it. A Well-Trained Wife is out. It's been out for a couple of days. Go grab a copy of it. It's well worth reading. It's extremely powerful. And for anybody who hasn't watched Shiny Happy People, you're featured in that as well. Mm-hmm. Season 2.
Maybe. I don't know. There's a similar.
Do you not know, or do you not know?
I truly do not know. Okay. There was some chat, but the chat has been really quiet for a long time through the strike. So I don't. Gotcha. I really don't know. Gotcha. But I can't imagine that a number one hit show is going to go nowhere.
So maybe, but there's so much to check out. Anywhere at Tia Loving's writer, you can see all of your ongoing writing. Her Substack newsletter is a must read. But thank you so much for joining me on today's episode, and I hope to see you again real soon.
Yes, thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.